Okay. So why work on large N, N is the number of colors. The first reason is to hopefully make a contribution to the search for a string representation of the planar limit. The second point I would like to make is that it is not necessary to get to very large N by doing N equals 4, 5, 6, 7, and extrapolate. That there is a shortcut, and the shortcut is the idea of reduction that I will come back to. The other point I would like to make is that even for massless quarks, quenching is okay at infinite N, meaning that unlike at finite N, where the quenched massless theory is actually divergent, this is not true at infinite N. More precisely, if you do the order of limits as described there, you first take N to infinity at a finite quark mass and then take the quark mass to zero, everything is fine. This is a bit of an embarrassment because there are lots of measurements that we have from the quenched era which extrapolated to zero quark mass of quantities that we now know should have given you infinity as an answer. Now, also there is a very important practical aspect is that this is a feasible problem for PC clusters of today. This is true for, probably will be true for the next 2, 3, 4 years. And personally, I think that full QCD with correct quarks is not yet fully feasible. So it's something to do if you want to be safer in terms of that you have the computer power that you need to do it. So there's a the main basis is a new form of large N reduction. And I will focus on reduction because sometimes the term is used too loosely and then different people think different things, what it means, and it causes confusion later on. So the experimental or empiric, the observation that is the main, the basis of all the results that I'm summarizing here is that pure Young Mills at anything at infinite N defined on a L to the fourth torus, so it is a torus which has a hypercubic symmetry. The group is the same as the lattice group, but this has nothing to do with lattice. So finite L to the fourth Euclidean torus has a quite rich phase structure, including a finite temperature transition, in spite of the fact that the system is never infinite in terms of its spatial extent. Reduction, roughly, and I'll make it more precise, means that if L is large enough, meaning larger than some scale, there is no dependence left on L at all, which basically means that the practical advantage is that you can think about simulating a system of an L which is just 10% bigger than some critical value, and there are no more any finite size effects to worry about. And using this sort of trick, the results that we have gotten so far is that we have understood spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking and its connection to random matrix theory, which produced an estimate for the condensate and an estimate for the pion decay constant at infinite N. And also, we obtained numerically the functional dependence on the pion mass squared on the quark mass at infinite N. So these are sort of, this is sort of a very short summary of the part results in my title. So let me try to start explaining reduction. It starts from lattice loop equations at infinite N, which have this schematic structure. On the left-hand side, you vary the contour, and you can think about it as a Laplacian in loop space. Then on the right-hand side, you have a sum of the possible splittings of the loop into two loops. So if the loop touches itself, there are these terms, and there is a coupling constant, which is the toothed coupling constant. Now, the main point is that loop equations are precise, unambiguous, and meaningful only on the lattice. Nothing continuum, despite much effort going into it. So that's why you need the lattice. But that doesn't mean that the result has to be only on the lattice. Now, what happens on the lattice is that you can go to lambda equals infinity, which is the infinite toothed coupling, and there the solution of this equation is unique, and it is just all the W's are zero. And then expand around it, around the lambda equals infinity, you will have a regime in which you have a unique solution. However, the Fulk law that I subscribe to, and I don't want, it's not the right place to go into a discussion why it is so, so accept it as an educated guess, is that actually the circle at lambda equals infinity is totally walled off from lambda equals zero. So you can't make excursions that would somehow analytically continue. That's a very large and niche thing. So now I'll go historical, because actually this is the best way to explain and distinguish the different things. Eguchi and Kawai were the ones that brought reduction to life. And they looked at the loop equations and showed that if you do them on an L to the fourth lattice, you have no dependence on L. No. My notation, capitals will be the number of sides, and lowercase will be a physical length. I'll try to keep that. And you cannot hear it, but you can see it. And they did not really state it explicitly, but it's very obvious that what they were doing is correct for any capital L. Clearly, the most exciting case is L equals 1, because then a four-dimensional lattice looks like your shoelaces if you have two long shoelaces and you have to do four loops. So this is the Eguchi-Kawai reduced model. It's a single site, and it is equivalent to an infinite lattice. And the result is rigorous, to the extent that rigorous things are in our field. It's correct in some small circle around lambda equals infinity. So that's a lattice result. And my friends and I, who were young at the time, got very interested in this thing, obviously. And we said, well, there is a integral representation for all of this, which is the path integral, and has inside the lambda. So even if this looks right only at lambda equals infinity, then nothing is going to stop us from expanding it around lambda equals zero, because we wanted to see how you get a Coulomb force in a lattice which has a single side. So the point is that Feynman diagrams are always something good to look at, and the space-time in Feynman diagrams, these are all the loop integrals you have to do. And the question was, where do the D4Ps come from if you don't have any P? And the answer was that there are many extrema to the action. So there is a moduli space or vacua, if you want, in more modern terminology. And you have to average over all this moduli space. And this averaging produces, for any diagram of L loops, the D4P1 up to D4PL that you need. So this was the main, it's relatively simple if you decide to ask the question, but this was the main observation of that work, to explicitly identify a mechanism by which large N reduction can work also outside the strong coupling regime, because it at the level of Feynman diagrams. Okay? Don't worry about the next statement. So then came a question, does the mechanism of momentum space generation out of group space also work when lambda goes to zero? And the answer was no. But that was not the main point of the paper. The main point of that work was to see how could it be true, such a wonderful thing, that space-time comes from the group. And the reason it doesn't work is that there's a certain symmetry, which is a simple generalization to four directions of the z that we know from finite temperature, the zn. And that symmetry breaks spontaneously. It can, because n is infinite. It breaks spontaneously when lambda is decreased from infinity. And then, when it breaks spontaneously, you lose the flatness. So it's no longer d for p, but there is a profile there. Okay? And then the question was, can you go back to the 1 to the 4 model and fix it somehow to maintain? So you force the symmetry on. And the answer we suggested was to use quenching to preserve the n. So this is a quenching of the variables which otherwise would collapse. It wasn't the prettiest, but it was sort of the most obvious thing to suggest. There was another suggestion which came soon after, which was more elegant, and you avoid quenching, but still maintain reduction by twisting. So that was Gonzalez Arroyo and Tokava. That thing actually had led in a naive continuum limit to the invention, essentially, of non-commutative field theory, something that came back 20 years later from another angle. So it was a useful thing. So since let's summarize the old reduction, quenching or twisting, that doesn't matter. You keep an L to the fourth lattice. You are on the, you're doing it on the lattice. You have a finite number of very large matrices. And reduction happens in lattice theory, where the momentum space is always compact. And it's only after, at the end, the last step is to take the continuum limit. So you don't speak about a reduction in the continuum limit. You speak about a reduction at the cutoff level. And the continuum limit is taken at the end. Gross and Kitasawa took the step to ask, do I have a reduction directly in the continuum limit? So they asked whether there was a quenched four matrix model that fully reproduces all continuum Feynman diagrams. And the answer was yes. Simply you take the naive continuum limit of the quenched the quenched version of Taguchi Kawai, which means you take each u mu and you write it as 1 plus I a mu, where a mu is Hermitian, and whatever you get defines for you the new model. But these people in the same paper observed that they're following their own line. The other new thing they did was to introduce fermions, and then and they noted that that instanton effects could not be reproduced because the naive form of FF Tweddle was just identical zero. The trace of FF Tweddle in the reduced model became zero because there was no X. And that also meant that when probed with fermions, you didn't get anomalies. So that meant that there was something wrong with this, and it wasn't perfect. But the idea that one should have a continuum reduction in continuum was right. So that's where we started 20 years later, where you could do things on the computer that you with ease. So naive attempts to decompactify momentum space. So the way you can think about a lattice in momentum space is, in one case, you compact lattice is just compactifying momentum space. Continue, you want to decompactify it. It has failed, in reduced manner, has failed in a subtle way, as we have seen. So then we said, OK, let's go back, start from scratch. Is there any continuum remnant of lattice large N reduction that has no known problems? So is there something that I can tell to my colleague who hates lattices and that no is a continuum field theorist, which would be a concrete message to that person that there is a property? And the answer is quite simple, that reduction holds on a continuum torus of size L to the fourth, so long as that size is bigger than LC. And LC is a physical scale. Okay? What does it really mean? You first take Young-Mills. It's very important. I'll repeat it several times. It's very important on what kind of manifold you're working. So it's a torus. It's a Euclidean finite torus. Okay? And then there exists a length, LC, such that so long as L is bigger than LC, any Wilson loop that you can then you calculate on the torus is independent at leading order in N of L. This is a finite and exact independence, just as surprising as reduction was, because if you thought about the Feynman diagram calculation, you would have all the sums over discrete momenta which have to disappear. Okay? The one confusing thing you should avoid doing is to think that there is a limitation on the size of the loop. There isn't one. If you should think about the loop just as a sequence of tangents that define the loop. And that sequence of tangents can be put on a torus of an arbitrary size. In other words, think about cooking, making dough, and you can roll a big Wilson loop on a small cylinder by having it go over it. It's not a good idea for cooking, but it is what happens here. I'm making pizza. Okay, what happened for L bigger than LC, there is a Zn to the fourth symmetry, and it is unbroken in entirety, and so is also this hypercubic symmetry group, which is the symmetry of this manifold. Now, on the continuum torus, momentum space is non-compact, but still discrete, so it's 2 pi over Ls, and since Z4 to the n is okay, when you look at the eigenareal angles of the Polyakov loops, which are theta mu I, and you distribute them on an A mu in that direction, on a constant A mu in that direction, you have to divide it by L. The eigenvalues, since Zn is preserved, the classical distribution of these eigenvalues is that they are uniformly distributed around the circle, and the determinant being 1 gives you this formula that they are, without the L there, the 2 pi k mu over n, where k mu is this integer, and the 1 over L you get because you have to put it on the A0, and by minimal substitution, this is the shift in momenta. So you see that the delta p nu just fill the gaps between these different discrete things, so it's a very natural general generalization of mirror image of what was there before, and that's how the L dependence gets to disappear from Feynman diagrams. But you also see that this argument will break down. You will not have a uniform distribution of the thetas once the Z is not preserved. Yes. So as L is lower to LC, one of the four directions, so that's now what you garner by doing simulations. It was not obvious what exactly will happen, except something has to. And what happens is that as L is lower to LC, one of the four directions gets picked randomly, and the associated Zn gets spontaneously broken. And the transition is first order, and Joe Kiskis showed numerical evidence earlier in the workshop for this fact. What happens is that if you look at the eigenvalue spectrum of the Polyakov loop, it was uniform before because the Zn just rotates, the Zn just moves all the eigenvalues by the same amount. Now, it's no longer required to be uniform, and it opens a gap. It's very much what you, any person who played with random matrices would expect, a random matrix that has been made unhappy to do. So what is a bit surprising is sort of that the system, the infinite nth system, suddenly discovers that one of the four directions is finite, but it still believes that all the others are infinite. Okay, so it jumps in one direction from something infinite, which would be zero temperature, directly to something finite. It cannot do for you the intermediate temperatures. Too low temperatures it cannot make, which is entirely consistent with what we knew already from Charles Thorne and so forth, that there is no temperature dependence, at least around t equals zero. Oh, the barriers between the two. My guess would be that they diverge in N, but I haven't researched that. I know that the tunneling events drop with increase N in rate. Okay. However, if the temperature is high enough, you do have a larger limit still. And you have reduction in the sense of the other directions. Now this is, I would submit to you, this result is a combination of some analytical logic which comes from loop equations so forth, and some numerical stuff which basically only establishes that LC is a physical quantity. So it is a pretty solid result, and it is one of the few results that I believe that we have that we really sort of can trust from the Young-Mills end point of view, which is stringy in character. And the reason it's stringy in character is, to go back to a paper by Attic and Witten, is basically the reason we have an L independence is on the torus size is that at leading order, okay, so there is this thing that you call a string theory which might be equivalent to the to planar QCD, one. Two, that thing that you think that it is a string theory has a coupling constant, which you say, because you're in the planar limit, is zero. In that case, the leading, you know, thinking string diagrams, which is maps from two-dimensional spaces into the target space, is the correct way to think. And the leading order is when you use a sphere in the world sheet, and that map into a torus cannot detect the fact that there is a torus, topologically, and since it cannot detect the fact that there is a torus, it cannot detect its size. So the independence of size that you see by reduction is something that it's natural in a string theory. And if you think about it from the point of view of a field theory, it is unnatural. They invite you to try to do this exercise with some O(n) nonlinear model, and you will see that no way, the size dependence does not disappear. This is, we are so far from even knowing what kind of, the point is, you extract the most basic thing from string theory. So what is it? One, that it's useful to think about, instead of Feynman diagrams, about the two-dimensional generalization maps. And the other, that there is a coupling constant, which governs the question of, which orders the contributions of different genera, you know, different topologies only of this world sheet. And that coupling constant, you say is zero because n is infinite. So it would be a non-interacting string theory. I do not believe that it is a string theory which is one of the ones that we know, if you call those critical strings. So it's not a 10-dimensional thing with some compactify to solar 26 or whatever, where you got with the Lutakia. And the Wilson loop probes, what is independent of L are really the Wilson loop probes, and the way to think about them is some insertions in the world sheet, like ordinary vertex functions, and these are the things that are independent of the target space L. And there is a free energy viewpoint in Attic and Witten, which comes at the point that the transition is caused by a winding mode going tachyonic in their analysis. Now, their analysis was not a torus, but was just finite temperature, so soon. And they also showed that there was a three-point coupling in that string theory that became non-zero, and therefore the transition that looked like it would be second order was sort of cut under by a first order transition. And here, this is a slightly different situation. You see the transition also breaks the hypercubic symmetry of the torus. So one would need an argument like that. These arguments were all made in a generic way, so in 26-dimensional bosonic, and then in the supersymmetric 10-dimensional cases, non-sophisticated, old-fashioned string theories. Okay, so now finally we get to what it is that you see on the computer. Now, this is a schematic picture, and I will tell you what I know for sure and what I guess. And there is a lot of work remaining to fill in this picture, but I hope you agree that there is a lot of potential to discover things. Okay. So you basically have, so what do I plot here? I plot, so you see, this is all lattice at the moment, and then I'll tell you what the continuum meaning of it is. On the lattice, I have lattices of size L to the fourth, from L going from 1 upwards, that goes along here. B is 1 over the Tuft coupling constant, so it's the beta with the appropriate power of n extracted, so you have a smooth large n limit. So we see that in total, there are 6 phases, okay, and they are very simple. Here you have, let's start from here. Here all 4 Zn's are broken. Here only 3. Here only 2. Here only 1. And there are 2 phases which have no Zn broken. And between them is a huge transition. I think first discovered by Gian and Mike, or Mike, I don't remember anymore, was it? Yes. Yeah. So by Mike, so this is the, right, I remember, right. So it was, the first was the SU5, and people were even for a while speculating whether it may have something to do with grand unification. Now, this is at infinite n. It's a very strong transition. It happens at rescale b 0.36. In agreement with reduction, it has no L dependence, except for the low L's, which I'm going to explain. So from L onwards, there. And the difference between the two phases is huge. And the best way to think about it is you look at the single Plaquette parallel transporter, you look at its eigenvalue, so if you want to know what is the transport of the most infinitesimal loop that you can have, parallel transport around it. That parallel transport in 0H, that spectrum is nowhere 0, so it covers the entire circle, while in 0C, it opens a huge gap, meaning that only eigenvalues near 1, eigenvalues of the Wilson loop or angles near 0, have any probability at all. So with probability 1, when you go around the plaquette, you will be transported only a small amount away from identity. So that's a big difference between 0H and 0C. Now in practice, at large end, there are big number of stabilities, and 0C, so C for cold and H for hot, extends metastably into the 0H region. So if you start here, you can easily do simulations here. That has a technical advantage because you can go down to lower Ls, and it is an analytic continuation of the day of here. So it's just a break. Now, here is where we were focusing. LL equals 1 with great effort 20 years ago. It was inconceivably. So this is a nice example where something as mundane as having real computer power makes a whole huge difference. It was not possible to find this 20 years ago, and now it was pretty easy to do that on PCs. Yes. So in 3 dimensions, the situation is entirely similar, except this is 3C and one phase is missing. And an interesting question is, what is the order of the transition 0C to 1C in that case? And I do not know the answer. Okay. Now, to find the continuum limit, you have to take B to infinity, which is lambda to 0. And you just raise a perpendicular to see which phases live. This one will not get there. This one is uninteresting. This one is total continuum. And it contains here everything that Wilson wrote the paper for at infinite n, if you take. So all the strong coupling expansion that we have grown to love is actually not the right way to think about confinement. It's separated from anything continuum by a huge impenetrable wall at infinite n. I don't know what conclusion you want to draw from this, but this is a fact. Okay, now there is, we focused on this phase because this is where we want to work, obviously. We want to work in the infinite volume limit, where we need all the z's conserved. The fact that this phase transition doesn't depend on L means that reduction holds both here and here. The reduced model does know about this transition. This one is a metastable extension of 0C into 0H. Right. Now you see what happened. When we were here, we missed this one. But this one is the one that we really wanted. And then we did all kinds of other things. But we didn't need to do that. Now there is a question, 4C, is it physical or not? There's an excellent candidate, it's Bjorken's femto universe at very high temperature. 3C is Bjorken's femto universe at zero temperature. 1C, which I just said, it's planar QCD at finite temperature. Don't know what 2C. Now, in order, yes. Now, we didn't really do this substantial work to make sure that when you raise this line here and you look at all these points, L, so you take a line and you move it that way and then you get 4 functions of L as a function of B, whether all these functions obey asymptotic freedom and whether there are finite distances between them. That will say that everything survives the continuum limit. We only focused on this because we want to work in here. But it would be interesting to fill out the rest of the diagram. Yeah, physically, if you are ADS-CFT motivated, you should sort of, you may think about various ways, so think two dimensions, various ways to fill up a bagel. Okay, so there's a little circle which you can fill up with bread, but you could have filled up the big circle with bread and make. So one of them you make contractible, the other not. So there are many more options in L to the fourth, and my feeling is that this is how you could explain what's going on if you knew how to make, more than you know. Here is just to remind you, schematically, this is very close to what you see on the lattice. It's not sort of that you mistake the transition. You see a distribution of the probability for an angle for a Polyakov uniform here that's Z symmetric. It opens a gap in one place that the simplest thing it can do. I have a superstition that the safest way to look for it is to take the limit n over primes so that you don't have other subgroups. But Luckily, there are enough primes, and somebody here assured me that I'll never run out of primes, so I'm feeling very good about that. So we now look at 0C to 1C transition, and you just plot LC as a function of B. You try to, you use, this we actually have done it a little bit better, but basically it is consistent with standard ways to make you believe that it has a continuum limit. So it is basically what you have to show is that LC as a function of B is described by a function like that. BI is the ordinate tuple improvement thing that you have to do. You know, this is, I use simple Wilson action. There's a lot of options to improve this thing by using other actions and so forth, which we haven't done. So this is sort of the last leg of the argument that what I'm, that the fact that there is reduction on a torus for L bigger than LC is a rigorous or an exact property of planar QCD, and it is a property that is string-like. So there is one thing, maybe it's not very impressive, but at least it is solid that relates the planar limit to, so, to a string theory. So there is the remaining question whether all the XC transitions have continuum limits. For those that do, does there exist an extension of the attic Witten explaining the sequential occurrence? Much of this extends to 3D, where non-perturbative issues are different. Okay, so what about the Grosky-Tazawa problems? Planar QCD is not replaced by a matrix model. So ordinary spacetime is kept continuous at short distances. So you never claim to have an exact representation of the continuum theory by a finite set of huge matrices. Okay? The number of matrices that you have to use has to be increased, and it plays the role of the ultraviolet cutoff of this theory. But really, in a continuum limit, you end up with an infinite number of matrices. And the UV procedure is a lattice procedure. And the two problems that Gross and Kitazawa pointed out about topology and anomalies work at the finite ultraviolet cutoff by employing new chiral fermions. So without new chiral fermions, there was no logical basis for a statement to see that we have overcome a problem, because you never had the certainty that indeed anomalies and topology were preserved by on the lattice. And here, the fact that the plaquette parallel transporter has a big gap is essential, because only that is the mechanism which allows the space of all gauge fields to break up into blobs which are separated from each other. Without that constraint, obviously the space is one space, doesn't break up. That constraint is a nonlinear, complicated constraint on the all link variables, and it is a rigorous statement, and I stand behind the word rigor at this point, that this will break up the space into disconnected components, which is what you need for topology. There's no way around it. So, Eguchi Kawai reduction in continuum, traces of Wilson loops that tensor on a torus are independent of torus size. L, if properly renormalized. So in the continuum, you know, there is an ordinary normalization. I'm looking only at loops which are smooth. There's a limitation in 3 and 4, there is a lowest LC. A question that comes to mind immediately is whether in the context of a supersymmetric theory where the original mechanism for the breaking of the Zn symmetry seems to be neutralized, whether LC would be zero in that case. And my suspicion is that even if the answer is yes, meaning for any torus you have no dependence on L, I do not believe that even then you will have a simple matrix model, meaning a finite number of matrices representing it, because the L that I have might still need to go to infinity, and all that would happen is that it doesn't go as fast as asymptotic freedom, and therefore LC turns out to be zero, but it's less than saying that you have just a finite number of huge matrices representing the planar limit. Fermions. Now, you have heard it often, but there's something precise which I want to stress. Open string probes, you have heard about it in many of the talks. And the probe is a concept dual to quenching in the sense that it doesn't have an impact on whatever the background is. In this case, it is the gauge field background. So this is a precise statement at n equals infinity. When string people do this probe approximation, this is not something that maps into something necessarily approximate. It maps into something exact in the planar limit. Okay. So fermions, for reasons that I hope will become clear, look to me the right way to probe this vacuum. Okay, let me see. I think I'm running. So there is a relation that Paul has touched upon a little bit. So I will skip over it about the case of spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking. So I'll just give you the general result and then I'll skip over it. So the list of fermionic results is the following. You can find the chiral condensate. There is a, you have to define it in a scheme and so forth. And a scheme, the 1 over n corrections seem to be relative small to n equals 3. This is following Tepper's list of objects that do not depend on n strongly between 3 and infinity. This is another one. However, the pion decay constant seems to have a large 1 over n correction, which is about 50%. So in a sense, it is probably the first time we see something that does have a 1 over n correction. Substantial one is not a big surprise to me, and it's also not, it's preliminary in a way. This is a rough first time that we do this. I for a while thought that it might be useful to technicolor people, but they really don't care about 50% one way or another. M pi, the formula that gives you the pion mass squared as a function of mq has a very simple behavior in the planar limit, and it's very well approximated numerically by a parabola, and that's what I want to devote the last minutes of my talk to. So let me skip this stuff. All right. So to get something firm that we can do, let's go to two dimensions. So in the two-dimensional TUF model, so which is planar QCD in two dimensions, I want to show you that this function, m pi squared of mq, if you knew it, you could in some sense reconstruct the entire Bessel equation. So what I'm looking for is something that I can do on the lattice, which could, if somebody comes with a more concrete string proposal, but he doesn't know a function in it, sort of by an inverse scattering method, allow me to reproduce it for him in a numerical way. Now, you can't ask the lattice what is the warp factor. You type it in, comes back error. The question, I mean. So I want to show you how this works. And the main observation is that this is entirely technical. It's correct mathematics, but I am hesitant on what it means. But the equation can be localized by adding some extra degree of freedom, and broadly speaking, it is similar to the ADS, where you could think in some cases you have an equation which gives you the mass of some particle. It is local if you keep the z, if you integrate it out the z, it will be a non-local equation. So that's the sort of level of analogy I'm looking at. So what's two dimensions? So I'm using equal quark masses. So this is Tuft's equation. X is the fraction of longitudinal momentum carried by one of the quarks in the meson. Phi is the wave function of the meson. Gamma mu squared, gamma measures m quark mass squared, and mu squared measures the meson mass squared. In two dimensions, you have a scale, so everything, the scale has been taken out from the coupling constant, and these are dimensionless quantities all over. And by a few, by some tricks, you can go from this equation to another equation, which is equivalent to it, where S now goes from minus infinity to infinity, and it is equal to the difference in rapidities. So it's log of x divided by 1 minus x. And also you see that mu squared actually likes to become in the potential, and what was the given, the input, likes to become the eigenvalue. And the main object is here. P is just I dds. And the main thing of this transformation was to take this non-locality, which is here, but it's the combinatorics is problematic, and simplify the combinatorics so you can write explicitly what the non-locality. Here it's non-local, right, in the sense that you would have an infinite series in X. Here I just can write it explicitly in a closed formula. But when you look at this, it's quite clearly that this wants to be the inverse of a Laplacian in two dimensions, where n are the other modes, the other direction. So you see that that's what I mean by localizing the equation. You just add that other thing, which looks like an open string with Neumann boundary conditions and with no zero mode, where psi sort of takes the role of the zero mode. And you say you write a quadratic action, which if you minimize it, gives you this equation. There is a starting point in which you say all p squareds are smaller than 1. Remember, it's now everything is dimensionless. Then I erase the p squared here, and the sum over 1 over n squared is a kosher convergent sum, which we can do, and that gives you this equation. And anybody who has taught quantum mechanics, seeing this equation brings a smile to his heart, because this is a well-known shape invariant potential. And when you solve this equation, it cries out for you to parameterize mu squared in terms of another variable, delta, which has this quadratic relation, which is also reminiscent of what you see, the ADS type of CFT equations do, type of equation doing, these delta count, they are second order equations, and you have a shift because you have a warp factor in the DZ coordinate. But here it's very different. Okay, delta is has nothing to do with the integers. Delta is just the quark mass, unitless quark mass. But this approximation is good to 10% for n all quark masses from 0 to infinity in the Tuft model. And now is the point, so this I mentioned already, that if you now say I'm going to take delta and assume that I know its series in the quark mass, I can invert this iteratively and reproduce this series here, the series in P squared. Okay? So the statement is, if somebody told you, you have to start from here, and gave you the series delta, the true delta in terms of square root of gamma, the full series, then you could reproduce this equation, which is the exact equation. So this is an example for this thing that if you knew m squared pi as a function to all orders around zero quark mass, all derivatives of it, you could reproduce the entire equation from it. So this is a speculation that maybe something similar holds for, so since time is getting short. So I'll show you what we have as a result, and this is not like presented in the paper. I mean, the graph is, but the results, I present them in a more accessible way. So in some reasonable physical definition, normal people would say that a meson for a very, very heavy quark should have a mass which is twice that heavy quark. So that tells you that you want to put a 4 here. And then the parametrization is here. So this is now a dimensionful parameter. And delta has a an expansion like so. And this guy is the one that will give you f pi eventually. In these units, these are the values of the parameters. And as I told you, the f pi that you get is 50% different from the continuum. You look at the dimensionless quantities, which are, you use LC, which is like the finite temperature transition, to set the scale, and you expand them as a, you plot them as a function of the lattice spacing squared, and you see this, you see there's a big extrapolation. There's a better way of doing the analysis, but actually this was the first thing that we did. It's closer to the raw data, which I like to do. So that's what we have. So let me summarize. In the planar limit, random matrix theory and field theory universalities meet and seem to coexist. I didn't say as much as I could have on this topic, but I still want to have it out there. There are two kinds of universalities we know now. Random matrix universalities, which basically say that a random matrix fills two things. One is that the levels repel, and somebody else that's trying to squeeze them together. And unless there is miraculous deals between these two guys, you will get one thing, and if there is a deal of a degree one, you will get something else, and so forth. And that these two things can live together with the ordinary field theoretical universality in the infinite n, because there are lots of matrices which have big n and the open gaps and things like that. Simulations at infinite, there are many new transitions that appear at n equals infinity. I didn't speak about all of them. Simulations at infinite nc seem feasible on a small PC cluster. The reason is basically that the number of operations per CPU goes like nc to the third, the communication. So there is a, it's a good problem for things that know how to compute faster than talk to each other. This is the right time to do this. And barring some unpleasant surprises, I could, you know, it could turn out that some big error in the logic of some kills this project. Barring unpleasant surprises, I believe that the wide spectrum of new problems will be addressed by numerical means in the Lorentz limit. And what I would like to see us providing is sort of a database of facts and things that people who do string modeling can refer to more directly than trying to go directly to QCD. I think there's no reason for them to try to do that. Thank you. Right. No, f pi squared is of order n, so all chiral logs go away. Otherwise, I would not have a function of m pi squared. This is very special, very important, crucial. No, before that, f pi squared is of order n. So when you have a q squared log q squared with an 1 over f pi squared, it's zero. This sounds very deep, but actually all I'm saying is mesons don't interact at infinite n. So nobody has pi on clouds because the cloud doesn't talk to anybody. Capital N, yeah, number of colors, yeah. Uh, okay, I did not do what you did, which should be done, which is put infinitely heavy sources and look at it. So all I can offer is a guess. My guess is extremely naive. At n equals infinity, QCD string has zero thickness. That's what I think should be there if it's to work. I mean, that's the beautiful thing, I hope. The rigidity I'm less sure about because I have to think what it really means. I don't think it's a... You know, rigidity is something that you define if you say that it is good to have a leading approximation in the sigma model, which is just first derivatives, and then you look at higher derivatives. Well, I don't know. I can put two sources. Okay, we can discuss this. I just don't know. I mean, it looks to me not trivial to define even the question. Absolutely. I agree. So there are 2 points. There are 2 points. He doesn't care about thickness. But okay, let's just summarize. There are 2 reasons for the string to not be just very thin and, you know, really classical one dimension. One is that the GS is non-zero, and the other one is that there is the expansion in alpha prime. So the other thing would be that the sigma model is on a space which is. There are 2 separate reasons. One of them goes away. That's what I meant. Oh, okay, I skipped, but it's kind of, I have a Dirac operator and then it's just an identity. Okay, so, you didn't, so the question is, why is that consistent with the linearity of n pi squared? Yeah, it is. The gamma pi, the other term, is gives you the linear behavior. Delta goes like mq, given by gamma pi. Lambda pi, sorry. Oh, how much it is? No, well, you know, there is a psi bar psi and f pi. Both of them come in into that slope. So to get you the f pi, I would have had to show you how I find the psi bar psi. Okay? So this all can be done. Well, no, this is the leading term when mq goes to zero is the 4 delta times lambda pi. Lambda pi is a finite number. So this is linear in MQ, and that thing will be the 2 capital B, which in ordinary QCD is 4 GeV. That one comes from psi bar psi divided by f pi squared. Okay, and psi bar psi is about 250 MeV squared, and f pi is, you should use the f pi for zero quark mass, which is 86 MeV, but I'm telling you that here, actually, it doesn't scale with square root of n so nicely when it goes down to n infinity. Yeah, it's all there. Yeah. Actually, it's only the series, but I skipped a point, that it is not true in the Tuft equation. If you ask a question about very heavy quarks, the expansion that I showed is useless, but there is another transformation of variables in which you interchange dds with q, well, you see what you would expect to see, which is a linear potential, because you have to remember that actually this equation I was showing you was in an unnatural variable for a space-time, namely the rapidity. But if you heard Joe Polchinski, so of course it's maybe not that unnatural to think about that as a real variable. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Well, I was trying to put it up. Yeah. Yeah. So, absolutely correct. What I'm trying to stress is that the capital L at infinite n plays the role of a UV cutoff. Nothing else. So there is, I believe, some lesson in it. I don't know precisely how to put it in words, but there is some lesson in it. So yeah, you have, now it's correct, but what really, just you said that what's correct, that correct thermodynamic limit, I think you had, your intention was correct, right? Just to avoid the possible confusion, what happens in 0C is that you're really independent of L. You wouldn't be in the other phases.